You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is it any better for the American government-funded scientists now that Barack Obama has replaced oil man George Bush? Dr. Francesca Griffo reports to the AAAS conference.
Anyway, good morning and thank you. You know, it's just so strange because as I sat here listening to the previous talk, I thought, are we talking about the United States and Canada, or are we talking about some other crazy part of the world? I mean, it just doesn't seem like this should really be how it is here. But sadly, it is. So basically, what I wanted to do this morning was tell you very quickly a little bit about the situation that we found ourselves in the previous administration in the U.S., and then talk a little bit about the work that we've done to try and get ourselves out of that situation. And hopefully, although our governments are very different, you know, we do have this democracy thing in common, and hopefully you might gain some insights from that and, you know, help you along your journey to try and stop this. So I think, as was alluded to before, both democracy and science are very much based on the free flow of information. Part of what we expect from our governments in a democracy is accountability, and that accountability really comes from transparency. And that's what this is about at its core. This isn't about some abstract right that scientists get to chatter about anything they want. This is about important information that has critical repercussions for our health, our safety, our environment, our world, our future, our children's future, and the ability to get that information out there so that we as citizens can really begin to evaluate and be a part of the decision-making process. So that's kind of why this is important. We began our work on this topic a number of years ago in the Bush administration. My apologies to chemists in the audience, but we took a little bit of license with the periodic table of the elements. And if you were to go to our website and click on each one of these elements, you would get to a one-page summary of, you know, an incident of political interference in science with primary documents. One of my personal favorites is when we caught up one of our higher-ups, political appointees in the Department of Interior, making track changes in a Word document, which she left in the track changes, changing the science so that we would have a different decision on endangered species. So that's the sort of thing that's in there. Now, these examples for us really spanned very, very diverse issues, beryllium, you know, pharmaceuticals, formaldehyde and plywood. I mean, you name it. If it was inconvenient for either the government or a donor to our previous government, they suppressed it or manipulated it. One very quick example, the lunchboxes, vinyl lunchboxes. One of the cheap ways to make that vinyl is to put lead in the vinyl. In our Consumer Product Safety Commission, they were doing tests on the vinyl. They got very high levels of lead. When they swiped, a supervisor came in and said to the scientist who was doing it, he said, "Oh, my God, these levels are off the charts." And the scientist, the supervisor said, "Well, what happens when you keep swiping?" And the scientist said, "Well, the levels go down." He said, "Good. Keep doing that until you get an average that's within the legal limit." So that's the sort of thing that was going on. That's the lunchbox my kid was licking yogurt off the side of, right? Okay, and yours, perhaps. So many, many different examples. And in fact, one of the things that we did was to really, now our work focuses on, because we've made some progress across the federal agencies, which I'll talk about, we're now focusing on the drivers of that political interference. And it really is, you know, the corporate interference is huge for us in the U.S. And this is actually the cover of a report that we released today, and there are executive summaries over there. So the major flagship example, if you will, of this was, of course, Dr. Hansen, Goddard Space Institute, a part of NASA, who wanted to speak out about climate scientists and was muzzled. Now, the silly thing was that he turned out to be muzzled by a public affairs official who didn't even, it turned out, have a college degree. He'd lied on his resume. So anyway, but the point is, this was caused a very, very big kerfluffle and really began the conversation about this. And I will say that in response, even in the last administration, NASA did make some changes. But what we wanted to do was go out beyond this sort of an example to really look at this not as an anecdote, but as a trend. So what we began to do were actually surveys of scientists in federal agencies. And over the years, we surveyed some, you know, 15,000 scientists across five agencies. And what we found was this. This is very typical. Actually, we surveyed many more than this. 42% of the respondents that we had said they feared retaliations for speaking out about their agency's mission-driven work. And this was not only outside the agencies with the media, But this was also inside the agencies where the decisions were being made. So this was pretty awful. And we have a number of surveys of different agencies that we've done. EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, our Food and Drug Administration, our U.S. Department of Agriculture, climate scientists, Fish and Wildlife Service scientists, so many, many different agencies that we looked at. And we found very similar results across those agencies. We then thought, okay, let's try to look at this in a little bit more depth. So we did another investigation where we looked at 15 federal regulatory and science agencies, and we examined their existing media policies, some of which we couldn't find. We have something similar to your, we call it our Freedom of Information Act request, where you can ask for these policies. And then we looked at, through interviews and, again, more surveys, the implementation of those policies. And what we found was not actually a very pretty picture. We did a scorecard. One of the things that we do is try to bring visibility to this issue, and this scorecard was quite successful. So on the left, you see the name of the agency, then you see what they got as a grade on the policy, and then in the right column, how that policy was actually being implemented. You see a lot of red. It wasn't good. And what we found was that very few agencies had decent policies. A few agencies had decent policies that weren't being fully implemented. And a couple of agencies actually had a pretty decent culture without having a policy, just simply because of the way that those agencies were run. And because if you look, you know, the agencies that did have a pretty good set of policies were those agencies that were pretty much purely scientific. Where you get the problems are where you have the science and the regulatory piece together in the same agency. As long as you have our U.S. Geological Survey, they don't have regulatory powers. They were being pretty much left alone. But of course, theoretically, this began to change when President Obama came to power. I guess he sort of has power, but came into office at any rate. Back in 2009, he promised immediately in his inauguration speech that he was going to restore science to its rightful place. We've spent a lot of time wondering what that actually means. But I think on the up and up, the trajectory is good. You know, they are really moving in the right direction, and we're quite happy about that. It's taken a little while. It was 2010 before our science advisor, Dr. John Holdren, very well-known climate scientist, actually came out with these guidelines for how to put together these scientific integrity policies for each of the agencies. Those policies have a number of different parts to them. We found, as we briefed agencies and met with agencies across the federal government, we worked with between 15 and 20 agencies, that in fact they were quite confused as to what this meant and how it could work. So one of the first things we did was actually pull together this document, which all of this is on our website. You know, what we found was that piecemeal, here and there across the government, different agencies had little bits of it right. So we took that and pulled it together into this one document so that it was already written in federalese, and it made them much more confident in their ability to adapt it. The fact that, Fish and Wildlife is actually doing that. You know, we can do it too. So this document, I think, was quite helpful as they went through and actually formulated these policies. Basically, what we're looking for and what we asked for in a public communications policy were these things. Personal views exception. This is what you were referring to earlier, which is, I still have First Amendment rights even though I work for the federal government, essentially. So you can speak about research results as a scientist representing your agency. But we get the fact that you cannot have every scientist across the federal government making policy. I mean, this is a really difficult thing to do. It would just be crazy. But what you can have is every scientist across the federal government taking off their scientist cap, putting it aside, putting on their citizen cap and saying, this is what I think these results mean. This is what I think we should do about this problem. And that's what we're asking for here. The second piece is the right of last review. What we also found, and I haven't heard this quite yet in Canada, is that a lot of documents would take the scientific research, rewrite it. It would come out in some other form bearing very little resemblance to the original scientific research results. So this is right of last review, so that before something like that is released to the public, if it's based substantively on the work of a scientist, that scientist gets to review it and make sure that it's still scientifically accurate. The third one, defined roles for public affairs officers and scientists. These folks are gatekeepers. I mean, these folks are, sorry, facilitators, not gatekeepers. In other words, they don't get to say yes or no to the interview, but they can be a partner. They can have a very important role at promoting the scientist, promoting the research results and so on, helping to write press releases. God knows, as scientists, we can use all the help we can get sometimes writing for other audiences. So we're not saying they don't have an important role, but it isn't a gatekeeper role by any means. And scientists, as a professional courtesy, should let them know when they do an interview. I mean, that's just the polite thing to do and a professional thing to do. Non-disclosure agreements, what we also found were many scientists were being asked to sign these, which said that they could not disclose information about anything they were doing. And we also think that this is an ongoing process. You need to have ongoing training for public affairs officers and scientists so they know what they're doing or not doing. So that's what we were calling for in our request for this. One of the ways that we did this was we had several of the agencies said, okay, we're going to put our draft policies out for public comment. We're very fortunate at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have very large networks of activists and scientists who work with us. Maybe some of you are in the room. But we asked them to weigh in and comment on these. So the first time we did that with the Department of Interior Policy, we had 3,000 comments. When we did it for the Environmental Protection Agency, we had 24,000 comments. And when we did it for NOAA, we had over 17,000 from activists and 165 unique comments. So this had a big impression on the agencies. My friend, who was a colleague working inside Interior, they did put out their draft policy. It was terrible. He called me the next day and he said, well, nothing like 3,000 comments to get the minister's attention or the minister equivalent. So it does have a way of focusing the mind in a way. Okay, so the current status. So what's going on now with these scientific integrity policies? Basically, we have a handful of agencies that have released policies. Department of Interior, USDA, EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, and of course NOAA has released theirs. What we found, though, was that really, out of all of those agencies, NOAA and the National Science Foundation are the two that have really tread new ground in media policies. They've really gone far beyond what we were asking for and actually in creating a policy that would do that. So that's quite wonderful. The other thing is that we've had to stay on our, I think, sort of maybe the equivalent of Privy Council in our Office of Science and Technology Policy and our Office of Management and Budget, these offices within the White House, we've really had to stay on top of them to keep this moving. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I phoned and asked about the status and really said, gosh, guys, I really need to know what's happening next because I'm going to be talking at AAAS. And sure enough, 2 days ago, they came out with a blog post, which announced, or actually yesterday, that final or near final policies must be made public by March 30th. So they're coming. We're getting them very quickly. The NOAA policy very quickly is really one of the best. I think it's due to the leadership of Dr. Jane Lubchenco. It's really good to have a great scientist at the top of an agency thinking about these issues. But essentially, it encourages scientists to publish data and findings. NOAA will offer knowledgeable spokespersons if a reporter doesn't know who they need to call. But if a reporter knows who they need to call, then scientists may freely speak to the media and the public about the technical material that's based on their work. And if they want to express a personal opinion, they may do that by taking that personal views exception and disclaimer. We have gone on and continue to survey federal scientists, and again, what we're finding now in our most recent survey of the FDA is that, in fact, there is still an enormous amount of confusion. Scientists are not sure how this works and what they need to be doing. So clearly, the major challenge left to us is implementation. So to summarize very quickly how we got to this point, which is, I think, a really good place to be. We're moving in the right direction, by exposing and bringing visibility to the examples. Document, document, document. Very important. We connected the censorship to the impacts on people's lives. This isn't an abstract issue. This is an issue that matters to people. We used congressional hearings to make agency heads accountable, in fact, very nervous. We made scientific integrity an election issue, an election issue. And we've kept the pressure on to really make these policies continue. So as I said, the current challenge is implementation. This is a huge task that we have ahead of us. And in fact, I'll be doing a symposium talk on Sunday at 8 a.m. specifically on this implementation piece and what that looks like. And we will have the folks in charge of this at a couple of our federal agencies there speaking. So I think that will be very interesting. Thank you.
That was Dr. Francesca Griffo from the Union of Concerned Scientists speaking at the 2012 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science on February 17th, as recorded by AVN.com.
Radio EcoShock.
At least scientists funded by the American government have a right to speak, something the Canadian government needs to learn. But plenty of pressure remains to keep the U.S. scientists quiet or minimize the risks, even as the climate tips us towards oblivion. As Griffo told the audience, it's still all about the money.
But I think there's one other elephant in the room that it's hard to not talk about, which is the enormous amounts of money that flow to campaigns, to elected officials, you know, at least in the U.S. I'm not speaking for Canada, but... And that has a huge influence. I mean, we know, we've seen this with multiple decisions that were going to have profound impacts on one sector of industry, that in fact that sector was heavily lobbying the White House, meeting with them over and over again, meeting with the heads of agencies. In particular, when we went to regulate ozone, you know, we know that they were meeting with Lisa Jackson, the head of our Environmental Protection Agency. She stood strong, which is the good news. But then, in fact, the White House put off the decision because of the enormous pressure. And it's about money.
Get the Union of Concerned Scientists report, How Corporations Corrupt Science at the Public's Expense, from UCSUSA.org, UCSUSA.org, or find this and other links in my blog at ecoshock.info.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.